Banker and brethren, needless to say, I feel very honored and very humbled to be included in this lineup, to be built on the same program with Messrs. Hoffman and Carloman and company. Makes you think of a story by Charlie Tapp, the erstwhile mayor of the city of Cincinnati and brother of the late senator. The story goes like this. His daughter was a fourth grader or so and was asked by her teacher to write an essay on who she is. And during the Tapp name, you see, this was not too difficult to do. She said, my grandfather was the president of the United States. My uncle was the United States Senator from the state of Ohio. My father was the mayor of the city of Cincinnati, and I'm a Brownie. And I feel I feel just like that little girl somehow or another as I take my place among you this evening, but gladly and happily, humbly, grateful for the privilege to share these thoughts with you. You've been busying yourselves these days with the present. And it behooves me of the word to be giving careful attention to the present with a view toward the future. But in my understanding of history, the task of the study of history is self-understanding, to be able to understand how we came to this present from that past and all the bearing that this has for the future. And that, to me, is what makes history such an exciting discipline of the mind. And strangely enough, Lutherans in general, and Missouri Synod Lutherans in particular, have been, frankly, neglectful in remembering and in evaluating our experience as a part of the American scene for more than a century now. The account of how we arrived at this present hour of our missionary undertaking is certainly an essential aspect of understanding for whither we are tending. And so the goal in this paper is to analyze our missionary task with a view toward understanding the diverse strands that work together in shaping our own missionary idea and some suggestions about the relevance that this task has for where we're going from here. Certainly, one of the most helpful levers available in prying open any aspect of the church's task is the conception and the practice of missions. For the missionary enterprise works like a magnet within the church's history, drawing up a revealing cross-section of those subterranean beliefs and assumptions and tendencies which comprise the stuff of church history. This evening, I invite you to join me in considering some of the forces which shaped the missionary idea among Lutherans in America in the 19th century, and more particularly, Lutherans of our own synodical tradition. As we do so, we might keep this in mind, that the missionary enterprise is not merely one among many functions of the church, displaying only the, quote, mission-mindedness, unquote, of a Christian body, but rather the missionary enterprise provides a direct connection to the mainstream of churchly life, revealing its characteristic manner and outlook and way of thinking. As I see it, three tributaries of Christian tradition flow together to shape the main current of the missionary idea and practice among our fathers. I'm going to be giving special attention to the last half of the 19th century. The first of these three strands, or tributaries, is what I shall call the evangelical Protestant mainstream of motives and methods. The second strand is given the somewhat cumbersome label of the evangelical confessional Lutheran tradition, by which I mean that movement, German in its origin, in the 1830s and the 1840s, which revived a very serious response to the Bible and to the confession, and which in turn triggered a very lively sense of the missionary responsibility among Lutherans both on the continent and in America. That stand I'm calling the evangelical confessional stand of the missionary roots of our own past. And the third tributary of our tradition I'm calling by the even more awkward label of the scholastic confessional Lutheran tradition, which came to prevail in the Missouri Synod, and which I believe always remained in tension with the previous two traditions described or mentioned here. Now, the crux of this interpretation is that the elements shaping the missionary idea among Lutherans were not theologically compatible elements, but they were elements that were thrown together willy-nilly and forced to remain together as the Missouri Synod forged its own response to the missionary mandate. And further elaboration and clarification of these three tributaries now follow. First of all, I'd like to try to clarify for you this general evangelical Protestant conception of the missionary enterprise. And when I say evangelical Protestant, I mean traditionally the American mainstream Protestant experience in missions. William Carey, Adam Island Judson, Samuel Mills, and Alexander Duff are among the names of the men who embodied the early 19th century evangelical Protestant image of the missionary era. These men represented a merging of the British and the American Methodist tradition, really, coupled together with a peculiar blending of two opposing strands of New England theology. The Second Great Awakening in New England around the 1790s and early 1800s had produced not only a new sense of obedience to the Great Commission based on a vivid personal conversion experience, but it also brought on a flowering of voluntary missionary societies established for the purpose of sending out emissaries to the unconverted both at home and abroad. The core of the American evangelical Protestant idea of the missionary task was the conversion experience of the individual. Timothy Dwight, Lyman Beecher, Judson and Mills were each one individuals who had passed through spiritual crises of brooding conviction, personal guilt, and eternal damnation, and then came their breakthrough to faith in a manner that was documentable on a certain day, at a certain hour, at a certain moment in their lives. Now, this was an altogether personal encounter without reference to the traditional sacramental means of grace. The requiring of this datable conversion experience serves to foster a common pattern of grassroots cooperation in the idea of the church and its mission among the American Protestant denominations generally grouped together in the evangelical family, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, etc. The church meant, in the view of the traditional American mainstream, it meant those of any evangelical denomination who, in John Wesley's words, whose heart had been strangely warmed over by the grace of Christ, and hence who could walk hand in hand. All of the smaller New England missionary societies formed around 1800, and the grandfather of all of the American Protestant missionary activities, namely the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, founded in 1810, well, this grandfather's parent society and all of the other satellite missionary societies in America around the turn of the 1800s, these missionary societies drew their constituency together across many denominational boundaries, and they gathered up missionary interest and participation from Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Baptists and Dutch Reformed. Now, this grassroots cooperation in foreign missions resulted in an astounding record of interdenominational and international cooperation during the first half of the 19th century. And the results of this cross-fertilizing and sharing of actual experience in arousing and sustaining the missionary enterprise, out of this emerge certain key motives for missionary activity, which are common to all Protestant groups in America. Let me mention seven of them. First of all, and probably the most common, is the idea, the motive of obedience to the Great Commission. William Carey, in his cobbler shop in England, read Matthew 28 and decided that this didn't just refer to the apostolic era, but it meant him. And so this theme of obedience to the Great Commission is a very prominent one in this pattern of motivation. Secondly, the glorification of God in the spirit of disinterested benevolence. They link a sense of fellow partnership with God in the carrying of the gospel to the ends of the earth. Or an awareness of the imminent end of the world, and hence an urgency to reach men everywhere with the word of grace. Five, the rescue of the perishing heathen from everlasting perdition. Six, the civilizing of the heathen, not only to plant the gospel in their hearts, but to put church on their back, too. And seven, the spirit of ascetic or heroic self-denunciation in adventuring for the Christian cause. Now, these half dozen or so motives appear and reappear in missionary literature used by all Protestants on both sides of the Atlantic. And the results in actual missionary participation, these motives evoked during the first half of the 19th century, were unequaled in the annals of Christendom. So listen to this. In the year 1800, there were virtually no Protestant missionaries abroad, as we know them now. By 1850, only a half a century later, there were very nearly 1,700 Protestant missionaries abroad, at work on five continents. And among them, there were more than 1.5 million converts, with more than 190,000 pupils in mission schools. And so no wonder Professor Lazarette calls the 19th the great missionary century. So in summary, of the chief characteristics of what I'm calling now the American mainstream, the evangelical Protestant mainstream of missionary motivation, two factors stand out. Number one, the necessity of a datable conversion experience. And number two, grassroots cooperation across denominational boundaries. Alexander Duff, the great Scotsman, missionary of the Scottish Missionary Society, reflected both of these accents in his message to the American Protestant evangelicals gathered at the first great missionary meeting in America in New York in 1854. This is what he said. Go and convert them, and then baptize them in whatever way you deem best. Only save their souls and rescue them from the grasp of the wicked ones and from those horrid British monsters of idolatry and superstition. I look for that day when the all-embracing Spirit of Christ shall rise up in the midst of us, when evangelical, Episcopal, or Presbyterian, or Baptist, or Congregational, or Methodist will say to each other, quote, for my part, if the gospel is preached, I do not care whether it be conveyed to an Episcopalian tube, or a Presbyterian tube, or any other. To the two characteristics now of individual conversion and interdenominational cooperation, a third characteristic might well be added. This characteristic of the American mainstream is what Lyman Beecher called, quote, the requisite of personal holiness. From Jonathan Edwards down to Charles Finney in the American tradition, the awakeners, the evangelists in our present day parlance, these evangelical awakeners had always tended to be very confident about their ability to detail just exactly what the Spirit would bring to pass in the sanctified life of the converted man. In other words, legalism always plagued Protestant American evangelical Christianity. And this indeed carried over into the missionary enterprise. Adoniram Judson, for example, reported that after that long years were required before the first convert was baptized in Burma, where he labored so heroically and faithfully for many years. And this was due not only to the recalcitrance of heathen hearts, but also, this is significant, to Judson's own insistence that, in his own words, each new Christian be obliged to know how to read, to renounce liquor, and to pledge himself to total abstinence. For each new believer was expected the promise to observe the morality set forth in the Bible. End of quote. Well, you get the feeling here that non-drinking and new life in the Spirit are inseparable. They're just hand in glove. Which looks very bad for many Lutherans, I suppose. Well, always lingering then in the Protestant sentiment concerning the ideal convert was this replica of the excellent New England way, this facsimile of the manner in which middle-class, sensible Yankee Christians dressed, spoke, organized their churches, and worshiped God. This third factor, namely the requisites of personal holiness, or legalism, which we commonly today speak of as non-theological factors, this was an ever-present reality in the Protestant missionary picture, and it wielded great influence upon Lutherans, as Lutherans drew generously from this stockpile, this ready-made, available core of experience in getting people off the bench and onto the boat. So much for the characteristics of the broad American mainstream, which must always be kept in mind, I think, in understanding how our own experience evolved against this background. Secondly, I'd like to say a word about what I'm calling evangelical confessionalism, in contrast to scholastic confessionalism. Evangelical confessionalism characterizes a tradition which had a contrasting origin and career when compared with the American evangelical experience that I've just described. Evangelical confessionalism points to a movement among German Lutherans, who, as mentioned above, revived a spirit of devotion to the biblical message of redemption, and who saw this message faithfully set forth in our Lutheran symbols of the 16th century. William Leah, Klaus Hans, Karl Graul. These are three examples of evangelical confessionals in the German scene in the mid-19th century, and each one stood squarely within the missionary tradition in Germany. These men, as heirs of the confessional heritage of the Reformation, retained a sense of continuity with the past and the present community of the Church Universal, something which never characterized American Protestantism. No sense of being a part of that great company of apostles and prophets and martyrs. American Protestant Christianity always was a victim of what is called the theory, namely from the biblical period down to 1790. And there are quite a few centuries that are spanned in the meanwhile. Well, I think that men like Leah and Graul and Hahn and their like, they had a much more vivid sense of the living tradition and continuity of the Church. These men saw the Lutheran confession as an ecumenical expression, and while they stoutly maintained the superior excellence of the Lutheran confession, they did not unchurch the adherence of other confessional traditions. Evangelical, the adjective here, means something distinct from the American connotations of this term. For in Europe, it meant simply the opposite to Roman Catholicism. In post-Reformation Germany, the evangelical churches were the non-Roman churches of the Catholic tradition, small c, of course. Hence, the historical circumstance out of which this older tradition of evangelicalism stems illumines its characteristic emphasis upon the proclaimed gospel of the grace of God through Jesus Christ, as distinct from his judgment and wrath revealed through the law. Here, the stress is upon the free, dynamic character of the word of forgiveness as the true treasure of the Church. It was the preached Evangelium that was central, for in this proclamation was contained the pivotal doctrine of justification by grace through faith. At its best, this tradition kept men mindful that the central doctrine of justification by grace was, to quote Bishop Buchfelberger, not just one article of faith among others, like one green tree among many green trees in the forest, but rather it was that one tree which made all trees green in the forest. Because this message of justification was that message alone which vitalizes and determines all, because it made audible to mankind the heartbeat of God through his Son, Jesus Christ. Now, two important influences were brought upon the Lutheran missionary idea from this evangelical confessional tradition in Germany. The first is a recovered sense of the visibility of the Church. Leah and Joel were among the leaders of a renewed Lutheran emphasis upon the tangible character of the one Christian Church wherever word and sacrament became the means whereby God summons men to faith. This sense of the living Church moves these Lutherans closer to a vital concern for and contact with the evangelical missionary enterprise which had been begun in England and in America. The second point concerns the relation of the Church to her confession. Confession did not mean a device for separating Christians, but rather one for uniting them. Quote, the Church is as old as her confession, for the confessions hold every Church together, unquote, Leah had written. Confession then meant essentially proclamation, and this within the context of the churchly community which bears its witness in word and deed to the grace of God in Christ. Rather than building the kingdom of God upon earth, the evangelical confessional saw the missionary vocation as that of proclaiming the reign of God already through grace. And although these evangelical confessionals had their own quota of non-theological baggage they attached to the proclamation, for example, they were also interested in making over their ideal converts in German dress, in German language, to sing German chorales, and to observe German customs, true as this was, they were not so inclined to legalism as were the American Protestant evangelicals. A much stronger sense that the living Church and the sacraments were sustained in this tradition in comparison to the American mainstream. And the necessity of a documentable conversion experience was nowhere to be found in this evangelical confessional conception of membership in the Church. Now, among the men of the Missouri Synod who reflected this strand of evangelical confessional consciousness, certain missionary figures stand out. Edward Bierlein, trained and sent by the Leipzig Society to America in the 1840s, was, I believe, the most gifted missionary statesman ever to take his place in the Missouri Synod. And it is indeed to be lamented that his brief period of work among the Chippewas of Michigan could not have been extended. He went back to Europe and then on to India, where he spent the latter years of his life in the Leipzig Society. So Bierlein is one magnificent figure. Another one, Friedrich Lochner, a student of Leah's, one of 70 Missouri pastors that Leah himself had trained for the church in this country. Lochner reflected this high tradition of continental Lutheran life at its best. And August Kramer and Ferdinand Sievers, prominent pastoral figures in the Bavarian mission colony sent to Saginaw County in 1846, were other bearers of this tradition into the Missouri Synod. It must not be forgotten that from the very inception of the Missouri Synod until the late 1870s, the chief point of contact between the Missouri Synod and the foreign missionary enterprise was the Leipzig Mission Society and its work in India. The Leipzig Society, along with the Hermannsburg Society under the leadership of the Harms dynasty, channeled a solid evangelical missionary witness into thousands of Lutheran homes in America. Virtually every Lutheraner from 1844 through 1876, and I've had to read them all, contains announcements of mission festival collections that went toward the Leipzig Society cause in India. The conditions which brought about a tragic break, and that adjective certainly cannot be overemphasized, a tragic break in the Missouri Leipzig connection will be mentioned shortly. With that, I hope something registers in your mind in connection with what I'm calling the evangelical confessional tradition. Now a word about the scholastic confessional tradition, which I think is so important as the third strand in this composite picture. Scholastic confessionalism must be more carefully defined and documented if the peculiar shape of the Missouri Synod missionary idea is to be at all appreciated. The center of the scholastic confessional concern was, in the language of the fathers, res gloribus Christ, correctness of belief in every detail. This tradition, drawing heavily from the post-Reformation era of Lutheran scholasticism, revived the visible-invisible conception of the Church and viewed the confession as a means to distinguish all dissidents from any given doctrine from participation in the congregation of those who possess reine Lehre, the full truth in all its purity. Those who refuse to drop conflicting views on any of the wide range of doctrines considered essential by the scholastic confessionals were relegated to the convenient limbo of the invisible Church. They were not pronounced as fallen from divine grace. They were, however, in error, and error and truth were incompatible. Truth here understood as rational assent, the one way of formulating the Christian revelation. This emphasis immediately suggests a particular view of what the mission of the Church is. Error had to be corrected, as well as truth proclaimed. Hence, the missionary task could, with equal validity, be described as setting erring Christians aright, as well as preaching to the non-Christians. As it turned out, it was not difficult to elevate this function of correcting the erring brethren to equal status with the mandate to carry the gospel to unbelievers. And as the history of the Missouri Synod mission shows, a clear priority was granted to correcting tasks over the proclaiming task. A very broad statement, and certainly open to debate. But by the close of the Civil War, when the high tide of German immigration to American shores kept most nautical pastors exhausted just meeting the boatloads of Lutherans pouring in from the continent, it soon became evident that correcting the erring was both more immediately convenient and more statistically impressive in meeting the demands of witness to those utterly unfamiliar with the Christian truth. It is my conviction that the triumvirate of leaders in the Missouri Synod during the third quarter of its existence, Carl Friedman Walter, Friedrich Wienerken, and William Zeeler, these three embodied the scholastic confessional spirit which hardened so disastrously during the latter decades of the 19th century. All three were profoundly influenced by personal religious experiences of renewal in their youth. All three represent a unique blending of pietism with post-Reformation Lutheran orthodoxy. All three cut off their contact with continental evangelical confessionals and cast their lot theologically with the free church tradition in Germany after the 1860s. All three combined their formidable influence to promote the home mission cause to fellow German Lutherans at what I believe was the expense of a wider concept of the missionary vocation given to the Church of Christ in the Great Commission. None of the three ever had more than a passing contact with any mission activity carried on among non-German Lutherans. The scholastic confessionalism these three revered leaders of the Missouri Synod succeeded in establishing as the theological hallmark of the Missouri Synod, this scholastic confessionalism effectively throttled the broader concept of mission nourished by the evangelical confessional orientation. As long as the scholastic confessional ideal prevailed, The sense of mission as witness to the non-Christian was, for all practical intents and purposes, doomed to immediate frustration and to ultimate oblivion. Now, the unique fact about the shaping of the Lutheran missionary idea among our forefathers is that the scholastic confessional, the evangelical confessional, and the American Protestant mainstream missionary traditions were strangely combined in the actual experience of working out the missionary path. And to see how this very unlikely combination of theological forces held together, we bring out examples from the historical record. And as we do this, we may keep our eyes open to this persistent pattern. The scholastic confessional spirit of mission motivation prevailed in the interpreting of the missionary experience to the home front, only to the member congregation. But, without exception, on the field, abroad, the actual program of preaching and teaching employed shows complete affinity with the broader evangelical practice. Three examples will be cited. The mission to the Indians in Michigan and Minnesota, the mission to Negroes in the South, and the mission to India. First of all, the mission to Indians in Michigan, 1846 to 1868. The first missionary venture of the Missouri Synod was launched by a colony of Bavarian Lutherans under the leadership of August Turner. Several hundred men and women, unusually well-trained laymen by William Lehrer in Bavaria, returned to Michigan in 1845 for the purpose of founding a mission colony. I think the only other parallel to this venture is the Moravian enterprise earlier in the American scene, where it wasn't so much one missionary called and sent abroad as a whole colony of shopkeepers and cobblers and farmers, etc., moving into an area to build a corporate witness to the non-Christian. Well, this Bavarian missionary colony is a very unique thing in the annals of American church history. August Turner explained the rationale for this colony venture in these words. The most purposeful way to do work among the Indians is through mission colonies. We think of it in this way. A missionary makes it known that he intends to lead a mission colony among the Indians. Men, youth of the Lutheran confession gather around him and call him as their pastor. They go forth and, in a designated place, establish a colony. The missionary preaches the word of God to the heathen, while the colonists contribute their part by the example of a Christian life in order to witness to the heathen. And a strong sense of the royal priesthood at work. The high optimism accompanying this missionary colony as they reached the Saginaw Bay area in 1846 was evident. Their image of the ideal Indian convert was based on the only experience that they had, namely Bavarian Lutheran Christian life. And so it was understandable that they expected the primitive Chippewa of the wilds of Saginaw Bay area in Michigan to turn into a chorale-singing, German chorale, no less, English catechism reciting Lutheran. Trilingual, German, English, Chippewa. And the Reformed Institute is a very interesting document of a catechism drawn up by Edward Bierlein. A remarkable document because of its trilingual character. I confirmation did think that they had it rocked at all. Well, to us, of course, this idea of making primitive over into trilingual, agrarian, middle-class sons of the Reformation sounds impossible. And imagine their consternation, however, upon arriving in the wilds of Michigan and learning just how the Indian could behave. How fairly they were jarred and shocked was suggested by Turner's report in observing his first government payday for the red man. He writes, "The cannibalistic noises, the brutish drunkenness and barbarity that go on cannot be described. One can think of the devil himself sits in these beasts bodily, and the love of drink is well used by the pulp agent to take away all their money immediately. One night, an Indian came to our door around 3 a.m. and positively wanted to break in. Just as he heard my stentorian voice, good Bavarian, you know, he fled away like a thief. I thought despondently to myself, but if the Lord does not work a miracle, all our work on this devilish race is lost. End quote. There were scattered evidences of laity coming into fruitful contact with a few Chippewas, but the colonists had not been in Michigan over a year before the sense of witness to the heathen had dropped away entirely. The Franklin Moose congregation established an elementary school for Indian children, which clung to a precarious existence for a dozen or more years, but by 1868, these mission to Indians was abandoned. And why? The contribution of non-theological factors toward the breakdown seems obvious enough, trilingual, etc. Chippewa's young world could not become a stable, agrarian, Germanic community overnight. Another factor was the departure of specially gifted men while the mission was yet young, both byline and trainers. These two men who did serve directly as missionaries to the Chippewas, the two men who remained beyond them were men of rather limited gift. But, I think, the underlying cause for the complete breakdown of the original intention was the absence of enough sustained, positive, evangelical thrust to hold the program together. One man, and one alone, embodied the quality of broader evangelical determination needed for the survival of the enterprise. And this man is one of the unsung heroes of our task. He is Ferdinand Seavers, pastor of the congregation of Sacrament, who never let the Missouri Synod forget that something essential to the life and health of any Christian community died when the Synod quietly buried the Indian cause in 1868. A product of the finest German evangelical confessional tradition, he was trained at Göttingen, at Berlin, at Halle, and in Andalusia. Seavers became a one-man gang for the mission cause during his long ministry from 1847 till 1893. He traveled relentlessly, cajoled his brother on every conference occasion he could seize, but he carried the burden almost single-handedly. And despite his efforts, the missionary idea among Muslims shifted during the peak of his career. From the original purpose of witness to the non-Christian, the overwhelming concern in the missionary idea was shifted to absorbing the incoming Lutheran immigrants into the Orthodox fold. This fact emerges from the synodical action of 1852, which resolved to close the major segment of Indian work in Michigan because the Indians refused to move to an area closer to where the Lutherans had settled. Synodical President Friedrich Winneken had commented publicly that, quote, "the Indians were hardly worth our care if they could not be persuaded to move," unquote. Seavers was clearly near desperation in his efforts to keep alive the Indian mission when he countered with these very interesting words in 1858. Quote, "Do not say that the people of the Chippewa Nation are too crude and the mission among them is hopeless. If one may speak of a nobility of natural man at all, then all observers of heathenmen capable of judgment agree that the Indians, especially the Chippewas, are to be counted among the most noble class of heathenmen, and that among them more of the faint spark of the original divine image is to be discovered than in the heathen of most any other land," unquote. Now, this sentiment would have provided very interesting dynamite, plenty, for the Iowa Synod forces during the election controversy 2 decades later. But it was clear that Seavers was not attempting to spell out any doctrine of natural knowledge of God. He was simply desperate in his attempt to stir and to awaken his brethren to keep on with the missionary enterprise to the Indians. Although a tiny Indian congregation had been formed in Michigan, the Synod, as such, did not deign to recognize them as bona fide Lutherans. The reason stated in the Synodical Report of 1857 goes like this. Quote, "The Indian congregation cannot be looked upon as a synodical congregation because of the difference in language. On this account, the congregation cannot send a deputy to the annual synodical meeting, and the synod is basically a German synod," end of quote. Well, this was less than helpful to the missionary cause, to say the least. 2 years later, this coolness to the Indian enterprise gained a larger following. At the 1860 synod held in Trinity Church, St. Louis, a group of pastors within the synod filed a denunciation of the American Indian as a subject utterly beyond hope of ever reaching with the full purity of Christian truth that the Missouri Synod alone possessed. The convention secretary recorded the viewpoint in these words: "The frightful moral perverseness of the Indians manifests itself in the vices of drunkenness and whoring, in countless examples of indifference to the gospel. In the many years of fruitless work at great cost, in the cheerlessness of our missionaries, which is expressed in so many ways in their reports and so forth, in the light of all these discouraging facts, might it not be better to give up the mission altogether and to use the considerable sum of money for the support of traveling preachers among our fellow Muslims scattered abroad?" End of quote. One of the saddest things that has ever been written, I think, in our tradition. This expression set the stage for one of those rare moments in the course of any church gathering when a man stands up and speaks the truth in love, with courage, and the quality of evangelical candor which put him head and shoulders above any man present in the synod at his time. Try to see Ferdinand Caesar in your mind's eye as he arose and said this to his clergy colleagues: "The moral decay of the Indians should not cause us to lose our way in the work God has given us. For the vices and shameful deeds which rule among them cannot astonish us, since they indeed lie in heathen blindness and darkness. If we want to give them up for the reason that we see little or no fruit, then we can just as well have the right to give up some of our German congregations as well, whose sins are no less offensive to God. But we did not start the mission for the reason that we hoped for great statistical fruit. It was rather because of the command of God. If he now has allowed us to see little or no fruit, that is no sign that we have worked in vain. Rather, God is testing our faith, whether we will be content to hope in his command and trust in his promise." His great words. Caesar succeeded in rescuing the mission from oblivion, but only for a time. In 1868, the thing was finally resolved and done. Again, it was only Ferdinand Caesar who expressed himself publicly that something vital had died in the church, with the giving up of the only attempt to reach persons other than those already Lutheran and solidly German. Dr. William Zeeler, one of the three most powerful men in the synod at the mid-19th century, had put an effective stopper on the Indian mission when he interpreted the tragic uprising in Minnesota by the Chippewas in 1862 as a clear sign of God that the dust from Lutheran feet was to be shaken against the Indians. As was mentioned before, it turned out that the very years following 1862 were a time of unprecedented progress in the Protestant cause among Indians. That is a documentable fact. But following this uprising in Minnesota, there was an era of fruitfulness in mission among Indians that has never been equal. But Zeeler saw it otherwise. But Zeeler and his co-laborers in the Missouri Synod had no eyes to see this. Their vision was turned across the Atlantic to Pastor Grimm in Sweden and his need for help in supplying preachers for the Missouri Synod. Everything worked in Zeeler's favor. He argued that support of Grimm was a definite fulfillment of the missionary obligation, and his feelings carried down to parish level. One mission festival sermon, for example, preached in Indiana late in the 1860s, indicates the completeness wherewith the grassroots missionary interests and energies were turned away from work among non mission to work among the Slavin Samoan. The immigrants, and remember that 500,000 immigrants had come to America from Germany from 1841 to 1850, the immigrant was pictured as, quote, an upright Lutheran Christian, with no other wish for himself, his wife, and children than to hear no one but a Lutheran preacher, and to affiliate with none other than a Lutheran pastor as his spiritual shepherd and guide. Some of the circuit riders found it wasn't quite this way. But what could be more sensible than this as the object of the missionary cause when compared with slow, recalcitrant Indians? The meaning of the missionary idea was effectively shifted to the plight of the incoming immigrant. Immigrant mission stations in New York and Baltimore began to occupy a lion's share of the Lutherana reporting on missions. And the numbers were impressive. In the year 1872 alone, 128,000 Germans reached the port of New York, and highly enthusiastic and no doubt idealistic descriptions of the eager immigrants hungry for the Lutheran gospel filled the pages of Der Lutheraner. With so many German-speaking, Lutheran exposed persons suddenly flooding the Midwest, the stage was set for a powerful new missionary thrust propelled, I believe, by the scholastic confessional ideal. Missionary Samuel Kyle of the Immigrant Mission in New York described his task primarily in terms of, quote, steering the immigrants away from the net of the fanatic, unquote. And Kyle toured Germany at fanatical expense in 1873 to attempt to establish a sure system for getting the jump on other Lutheran groups by establishing free church embarkation centers in German ports, which would direct immigrants safely into the Missouri Synod counterparts in New York and Baltimore. Meanwhile, the Midwest was crisscrossed with numerous circuit riders who faithfully sought out German newcomers to the land. During the short space of 3 years, from 1872 to 1875, the number of congregations in the Synod jumped from 499 to 662. The number of souls under pastoral care from 77,000 to 112,000, and the number of preaching stations maintained by circuit riders from 109 to 257, just a three-year space. Little wonder, then, that the mission energies were entirely absorbed in the gathering up of these newcomers into Orthodox congregations. The scholastic, confessional type of missionary motivation was well-suited to this. Walter wrote numerous tracts for distribution among the newcomers, which made clear who the holders of pure truth were in the new land. Quote, the Lutheran Church is the only one which believes correctly, and therefore it is the true visible church of God on earth, unquote. The enterprise involved in making that claim stick consumed all the energy that could go under the name of mission. The fateful dichotomy between home and foreign mission, the clear priority of the former, had been firmly fixed. From this point on, the scholastic confessional theology which prevailed in the Synod at large conditioned the missionary idea entirely, and every phase of missionary thrust throughout the rest of the century had to define itself to and relate itself with this predominant theological mood of the Missouri Synod. The missionary experience of Lutherans among Negroes in the United States presents a clearer picture of the manner in which the scholastic confessional idea was used to prime the home front for support of the cause, while the evangelical tradition was recruited for the actual implementing of the work. In 1878, a decade after the close of the Indian work, the president of the recently formed Synodical Conference asked the conference whether it was not time to devote attention to heathen missions and bring into being a mission among the Negroes or the Indians. His reasoning was interesting. Listen. If we make no use of the desire of our Lutheran Christians to do something for heathen missions, they will surely apply their means where we would not like to see it go. For the missionary societies of Germany, just as the state church, takes on an increasingly hostile attitude toward us. And for that reason, We cannot conscientiously support them anymore. This is the beginning of the break off completely of ties between our forefathers and the best of the Lutheran tradition on the continent. One of the major tragedies of the 19th century that we're still living with the baneful results of. Missionary activity was being urged once more because Lutheran dollars just might stray off to dubious coffers. 3 years prior to this, in 1876, Walter had personally supervised the arrangement whereby two headstrong young German missionaries from the Leipzig Society, Karl Montag Thorn and Fritz Sucker, were bailed out of their difficulties with their field colleagues in India and welcomed to the Missouri Synod. Both had declared that they could not be sure of the forgiveness of their sins as long as the Leipzig Society Board of Directors retained a certain professor on its membership back in Germany. Yeah, this is documentable, you see. Walter had learned of their situation and had paid their fare to America before officials of the Leipzig Society could settle the problem. But when Preuss, a spokesman for the Synodical Conference, has stated that, quote, the missionary societies of Germany take an increasingly hostile attitude toward us, unquote, the reasons ought to have been more objectively stated. But the tragic Cold War between the Missouri Synod and the best of continental Lutheran theology was already well underway. And this meant a break in the long-standing relations between the Leipzig Society and the men of Missouri. And so, in order to prevent missionary energies from running astray, the Synodical Conference decided it was time to begin missions among Negroes. An intrepid Dakota Territory circuit preacher, John Desher, one of the most technicolor figures in our past, Desher was commissioned as the first missionary to Negroes in 1877. But the freewheeling Desher, he did not hesitate to fill Methodist and Baptist pulpits when invited to do so. He did not fare too well under the scrutiny of home officials. And he was dismissed in 1881. But Desher was the very embodiment of the American evangelical spirit. You see, that we have more time to tell some of the lore about this man, Desher. Walter had selected him and helped to ordain him. And what a boomerang that turned out to be. You know, the reason why he was dismissed, it was mental instability, so to speak, in New Orleans. He had been a pastor at St. Paul's Church in New Orleans, and his fellow effort was all over. At the other extreme, now from Desher, were several other early synodical appointees to the field of Negro missions. Friedrich Berg, Lawrence Zahl, W.R. Bueller, and George Allenbach all tried to run the work by the book, that is, to remake Negroes in the scholastic confessional mold. But each gave it up as a hopeless task within a year of trying. Milt Bakke, here's a name to remember, Bakke, B-A-K-K-E, an 1880 graduate of the St. Louis Seminary, a Norwegian, and hence a sort of off-color character. There are many skeletons rattling in the closet for so many Lutherans. Milt Bakke, an 1880 graduate of the St. Louis Seminary, is the first Lutheran missionary who stayed with the difficult work, and his record indicates the curious manner in which the motive of recommending the cause to the home constituency differed from what he said to the Negroes in New Orleans. For example, in 1890, he addressed a white audience at St. Paul's Church, New Orleans, on the occasion of their golden anniversary. Speaking in particular about parochial schools, he rehearsed all the familiar true visible church phrases in the ears of his German Lutheran hearers. Since we are the true visible church upon earth, he reasoned, we of all people ought to be most zealous in the work of missions. A possession of the full truth, as no others possessed it, Bhakti hinted broadly, is inestimably valuable, not only for the white, but for the black as well. And then he went on to depict the plight of the Negro in terms which spared no detail of the black man's misery. Yet, when Bhakti taught and preached among the Negroes of Carrollton, Louisiana, for instance, he called everyone a Lutheran, quote, who was a Bible Christian, who regarded the divine word as the rule and norm in all matters, end of quote. And Bhakti further revealed that he was even willing that Negroes could, in his own words, do a little shouting in Lutheran churches, if it meant that this would be the only place that they would hear the gospel. For 40 long years, Milt Bhakti had to maintain this split personality existence, relaying all the right words to the home front and going about the task before him as his evangelical instincts led him. In this connection, it is most interesting to compare the tone of missionary reporting that appeared in the standard miracle house organ, Der Lutheraner, with that of another less auspicious periodical which appeared in the Synod from 1880 on. The Lutheran Pioneer was called. The Pioneer was devoted almost entirely to the cause of missions to the Southern Negroes. It was intended for Negroes, Yankees, and any other English-speaking foreigners in America. And hence, the Lutheran Pioneer never contained any of the vigorous polemic against non-Lutherans so characteristic of Der Lutheraner. The thrust of the Pioneer, for example, was suggested by frequent articles asking, quote, are you born again? Well, Der Lutheraner, which spoke loosely about Negroes as the children of a hen, was worlds away from the little Pioneer, for the Pioneer featured homey little parables about old Aunt Judy, a Negro nanny, who, though confined to her sickbed in her lowly cabin, could still set young seminarians straight on the doctrine of grace when they came to visit her. So much depended upon who comprised the reader audience. If it was traditional German Lutheran family on the plains of Nebraska, the appeal was to how much the pure Lutheran gospel could accomplish among the benighted black. But if it was a Negro family in New Orleans, it was old Aunt Judy who was the hero. Very significant, interesting thing. The difference between the two represents the difference between the scholastic confessional and the American evangelical tradition. Now a word about the mission to India in 1894. Circumstances surrounding the establishment of the first foreign mission enterprise of the Missouri Synod, namely the work in India, reveals a similar merging of the opposite theological traditions we've been describing. In 1894, a repetition of the 1875 clash involving the Leipzig Society, Thorne, Hooker, and the Missouri Synod took place. In 1894, a young Leipzig Society missionary, Theodore Mather, was the center of a dispute which began around a cantankerous mission station personnel individual, and eventually from that personal grievance, the dispute moved over to the more respectable theological ground. Young Mather, only 5 years along in his missionary career in India, accused his colleague of attacking what he called the very foundation of Christian faith and life when they refused to subscribe unanimously to a paper that he had read, interestingly enough, on the doctrine of the inspiration of Scripture. Now this thing has bugged us over the last century. Mather resorted, unfortunately, to the dubious course of skirting the existing channels to settle the matter, and sent his paper, together with a meticulous transcript of all the speeches and their authors, to a free church publication in Fractionate. The Leipzig Society leaders were understandably aroused over this manner of broadcasting internal field disputes, and immediately they called Mather to task. How the Missouri Synod became allied with Theodore Mather is another lengthy story which need not concern us here now, but let it suffice to say. But the Senate again paid the bill for Napier's and another colleague's trip to America. After passing a hair-raising colloquy, the two men were commissioned to service in India at St. Charles in October of 1894. The sermon was preached, interestingly enough, by Carl Montai Choi. Theodore Napier's theological career up to this point illustrates well the nature of the scholastic confessional problem on the mission field. When an issue of doubt arose over one area of sub-theological nature, the entire missionary vocation came tumbling down. The fact that his colleagues adopted a resolution affirming their belief in the inspired scripture.